pollution and health issues, climate change, aviation, weather. There was even a web page on the White House website about the U.S. Constitution that's not there anymore. And so the good news is that we've gotten pretty good at this effort. We, as I said, had done a very thorough job of archiving this material. I should also say that we do this work in collaboration with many other organizations. This end-of-term archive is a team effort. We work with Harvard's Library Innovation Lab, the University of North Texas, Stanford Libraries, the Common Crawl Foundation, and EDGE, Environmental and Data Governance Initiative. And I want to highlight the work of EDGE because what they have historically done is after the fact, after a change of presidential administration, they've gone in and tried to analyze what in fact had changed when the new administration came in. So they're deep in doing that work now. We also,
at the Internet Archive, we have 20 seconds for this segment, Mark.
Excellent. Okay. So, you know, I'd say the Wayback Machine is available to anyone. It's a free public service
at web.archive.org. Will it stay up?
It's stayed up for 28 years, and we're pretty sure it's going to stay up for at least 28 more.
So, Mark,
absolutely.
We want you to stay with us. This is all too important. Mark Graham is the director of the Wayback Machine at the Internet Archive, also part of the end-of-term archive for federal websites. We'll do part two, web exclusive, posted online. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
You're listening to KBOO's All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 4 Special Programming Campaign. Check out all the great special programs we're bringing you now through April 15th at kboo.fm/ATNF4.
Friday, March 14th at 8 p.m., KBOO makes everything metal. The Metal March returns again in 2025, featuring 10 hours of live bands and DJ sets from your favorite KBOO metal hosts. March 4th and support metal on KBOO. Text KBOO to 44321 or go to kboo.fm/give to donate. And tune in to the Metal March, Friday, March 14th at 8 p.m. through Saturday, March 15th at 6 a.m. Metal takes over the airwaves for the Metal March Metal Marathon, only on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland's city administrator releases a first look at what budget cuts the city could make.
Unionized professors at Portland State University inch towards a strike.
And in international news, carbon offsets may be doing more harm than good.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, February 28th, 2025. I'm Althea Billings.
And I'm Sam Bowman. Portland City Administrator Mike Jordan released a first draft of a plan for how to balance Portland's budget this year. The city faces a $93 million shortfall, down from a $100 million estimate a few weeks ago. The shortfall is happening for a few reasons. Inflation, expiring pandemic-era funding, overtime for firefighters and cops, and health care cost increases are all having an effect. Much of the city's revenue comes from property and business taxes, but those revenues have been down too. The $93 million shortfall is from the city general fund. But there's an extra $65 million shortfall for parks, transportation, permitting, and the water and sewer bureaus, which are funded separately. Jordan's first draft plan only includes a pitch for $32 million in cuts, about a third of what the mayor and council will ultimately have to cut. Usually, the budget is made public with everything already decided and balanced. This year, since it's a new system of government and a new process, Jordan published some concrete cuts to make and a menu of options for the community to weigh in on.
The cuts are serious and will be felt across city services. There's $22 million in proposed cuts for PBOT's street maintenance and repair program. Parks may have to slim down community center hours and end summer programs. At least 300 jobs across city bureaus would be eliminated, though some are currently vacant. And that would still only get Portland part of the way there. Restructuring city bureaus could lend more savings, but that work is still in the early stages. Jordan did outline what cuts to fire, police, and emergency services would look like, but put that in his report as not recommended. He says it's a starting point for conversations. Quote, we've decided this year that we're going to go to the public with the kind of tipping point questions that we would really like their feedback on. What's most important to you? If we have to cut a budget, which one would you cut? End quote. Public listening sessions on the proposed budget cuts will be held in each electoral district in March and April. Mayor Keith Wilson will be responsible for creating the final balanced budget. That's expected to be published on May 1st.
Unionized professors at Portland State University are inching closer to a possible strike as they declare an impasse in bargaining with the university. That means that both sides are no longer making progress on their new labor contract. The American Association of University Professors represents about 1,200 faculty and professors at PSU. There are a few sticking points. The union says student support services are understaffed, the faculty is being consolidated and sometimes laid off, and the professors need a cost of living adjustment. A cost of living adjustment, or COLA, is used in union contracts to adjust wages to match with the rate of inflation. For workers whose contracts don't have a COLA, the value of their wage actually decreases each year, especially if they don't get raises. The union proposed a 7.5% cost of living adjustment, and the university pushed for a roughly 3% raise with a $500 signing bonus. A PSU spokesperson said in a statement, quote, PSU remains committed to reaching a fair agreement that meets the needs and interests of our employees, protects our students' investment in their future, advances PSU's strategic goals, and supports our long-term financial sustainability, end quote. If the parties cannot make progress on a new contract before March 30th, the professors' union will go on strike.
The market for carbon offsets is estimated to be around $800 billion, but experts say they often fail to do what they say they will. KBOO's Elam Case has more.
There's a growing consensus among experts that carbon offsets are not an effective tool for fighting climate change. They are meant to reduce carbon dioxide emissions, but in some cases may do more harm than good. A carbon offset is when some entity, a person or company, buys a carbon credit, meaning they're paying someone else to reduce emissions in some other way. Tina Swanson is a senior scientist at the environmental nonprofit Project Drawdown. She says there are major issues with the way this system, now an estimated $800 billion market, works.
There's the math problem. There's the credibility problem. And there's the moral hazard problem.
As a result of these problems, Swanson says many carbon offsets provide few to no benefits. Others actively make climate change worse by enabling polluters like the meat and dairy industry to avoid making any changes. A 2023 investigation into Verra, the leading certifier of voluntary carbon offsets, found that up to 90% of the nonprofit's rainforest offsets were worthless and did not bring about a reduction in emissions. Swanson says that's because offsetting doesn't actually reduce the number of emissions produced.
But the effect of that is only that it shifts deforestation to somewhere else. Or whether you buy a carbon credit purporting to reduce emissions by this much, but it actually doesn't.
A 2017 study by the European Commission found that 85% of offsets used by the European Union under the UN's Clean Development Mechanism also didn't reduce carbon emissions. This story was produced with original reporting from Seth Milstein for Sentient. For KBOO News and the Public News Service, I'm Elam Case.
Senate Republicans say they'll change the House's budget resolution. Trump questions whether he called the Ukrainian president a dictator ahead of his White House visit, and environmental groups question EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin's call for deregulation. With more on these stories, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I have a very good relationship with President Putin. I think I have a very good relationship with President Zelensky. And now we're, you know, we're doing the deal and we're going to be in there. We're going to be actually in there, digging our hearts out.
President Donald Trump says he looks forward to meeting with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky at the White House today to finalize an agreement giving the U.S. access to Ukraine's rare earth minerals. During a meeting with British Prime Minister Keir Starmer, Trump denied calling Zelensky a dictator, despite using the term about the Ukrainian leader on social media last week. After the meeting, Starmer stressed the European position that any Ukraine peace deal must stop Russian President Vladimir Putin from deciding to invade again, as he did twice in a dozen years. Senate Republicans have said they'll likely make hefty changes to the budget resolution the House just passed. Majority Leader John Thune says any Republican tax bill must include a permanent extension of Trump's 2017 tax cuts. EPA head Lee Zeldin has urged the White House to strike down a 2009 determination that greenhouse gases endanger human health, which let the agency set limits on CO2 from cars and power plants. Stephanie Reese with Moms Clean Air Force says that contradicts Zeldin's promise to follow the science.
He must keep EPA on course and rein in climate and air pollution. To do otherwise is a cynical and shameful betrayal, one that history will not forget.
Conservatives say the repeal is a necessary step towards ending burdensome regulations. Environmentalists say climate change and fossil fuel air pollution itself kill tens of thousands every year. Transgender service members, including those diagnosed with gender dysphoria, will be forced from the military without a special waiver under a new Pentagon policy. 24-year-old Clayton McAllister, a transgender man in the Air Force, says there's no reason to treat it differently than any health diagnosis.
Any kind of procedure that a trans person would go through is the same downtime for someone that needs to have knee surgery. You know, I know a lot of active duty people that have to have knee surgery or anything like that.
The new defense secretary has said being trans contradicts a soldier's commitment to an honorable, truthful, and disciplined lifestyle. Fox News anchor Brett Baer says he's concerned about the White House taking control of which media outlets will be allowed to travel with the president and cover events with limited space.
This is a reordering. We'll have to see how it shakes out. I just, you know, I worry about setting precedent that changes things down the road, and maybe they don't realize the implications of it.
I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
The hauling of uranium ore through the Navajo Nation has restarted, and the acting attorney general for the tribe addressed people's concerns this week. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Navajo Nation officials this week addressed ongoing concerns about the recent restart of uranium ore hauling through the reservation. Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports it follows months of negotiations with the owners of a mine near the Grand Canyon.
In an online video, acting Navajo Attorney General Heather Claw said the tribe was unable to prevent the transport despite opposition from many residents, lawmakers, and Navajo President Boo Nigrin. The tribe doesn't have jurisdiction over the haul route, which is made up of state and federal highways.
So the next best thing that we needed to go ahead and do is to make sure that we protected our Navajo Nation people. So that's why we took the approach of negotiating terms in order to make sure that this agreement provides those protections.
Navajo officials can now inspect the truckloads before they enter the reservation, and the shipments are limited to certain hours and days. The agreement also includes emergency response procedures and several other provisions. Stephen Etzedy, executive director of the tribe's Environmental Protection Agency, pointed out that the mine is fully permitted with state and federal agencies.
We took that and trying to develop as many mechanisms as we can to push the limits of regulation and oversight on this transport transport activity for the benefit of our communities, and that's where we remain focused.
Earlier this month, 25-ton trucks of uranium ore left the Pinyon Plain mine near the south rim of the Grand Canyon, bound for a mill in southern Utah. The shipments passed through several northern Arizona communities and a large swath of the Navajo Nation. The tribe expects 10 trucks per day for the next 2 to 4 years. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heiches in Flagstaff.
A young boy from White Mountain, Alaska, leaped into action recently when flames enveloped his family's home. And as KNOM's Ben Townsend tells us, the second grader likely saved his great-grandmother's life.
Roseanne Titus was getting ready for the day on Thursday morning when she saw flames coming from a bathroom at the front of the house. Her granddaughter and great-grandson were still in bed. Titus tried unsuccessfully to put out the fire and then rushed to wake up her family. But the flames had spread into the hallway, blocking the way out of the house. That's when her great-grandson, 8-year-old Colton Kanuka Couchy, sprang into action.
He kind of jumped out the window and ran for help.
That's Colton's mother, Vanessa Marie Kanuka. She said her son plunged 10 feet from the window to a snowdrift below. He ran through deep snow to get help, which came in the form of Shane Bergamashi, a volunteer firefighter. Bergamashi helped pull Titus through a window and rushed her to the local clinic to await a medevac.
They helped us right away when we got in with my grandma's burns and smoke inhalation. I only had a popped knee and a few frostbites on my toes.
Titus was flown to Anchorage, where she was treated for burns on her shoulder and arm. The home was a loss, including personal belongings and 2 moose legs from a recent hunt. Despite the heartbreak of losing the family home, Colton's grandmother, Nora Brown, who was not in the home at the time, credited her grandson with keeping the situation from getting much worse.
We would have probably lost my mother, and the houses nearby probably would have caught fire also.
Bering Air is ferrying donations to the family, and a GoFundMe has been set up. Reporting in Nome, I'm Ben Townsend.
The National Museum of the American Indian in Washington, D.C. is displaying 2 gowns worn by Oscar-nominated actor Lily Gladstone. The installation opens Friday ahead of Sunday's Oscars. Both gowns were a custom collaboration designed by Gucci and indigenous artist Joe Big Mountain, featuring native design and quill work. 4 public programs are planned in March. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's KBOO's Black History and Futures Month series. This week, host Tina Turner Morfitt tackles reproductive health with the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. Then at 7, it's Once Upon a Time. Tonight's weather will be clear with an overnight low of 39 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy with a high of 59 degrees. Today in history, in 2013, Pope Benedict XVI resigned as head of the Catholic Church, the first pope to do so since 1415. The quote of the day is from French writer Michel de Montaigne, born this day in 1533. He wrote, quote, "Truly man is a marvelously vain, diverse, and undulating object. It is hard to found any constant and uniform judgment upon him."
Faith leaders and advocates are calling for urgent action to address inhumane heat conditions in U.S. prisons, particularly in southern states like Mississippi. There, extreme temperatures and humidity pose life-threatening risks to incarcerated individuals and staff. Tramell Gomes explains.
As spring approaches, faith leaders and advocates are raising alarms about inhumane heat conditions in U.S. prisons, especially in southern states like Mississippi, where extreme temperatures threaten the lives of incarcerated individuals and staff. During a recent webinar, 85 to Stay Alive Answering the Call, hosted by Texas Prison Community Advocates and the Climate and Incarceration Research Collective, panelists shared harrowing stories and urged action before summer heat arrives. Reverend Joseph Clark, assistant imam at the 5th Ward Islamic Center for Human Development in Texas, recounted his own prison experiences describing dangerous conditions caused by extreme heat.
It would be so hot on the unit that we would break out the windows on the turn row so air can come through the windows. And warden would not fix the window purposely for when it got cold. So during the winter conditions, we would freeze to death.
The problem is severe in Mississippi, where many prisons lack air conditioning. Reports frequently expose extreme heat at the Mississippi State Penitentiary at Parchman, where cell temperatures often exceed 100 degrees. The Justice Department has found conditions at Parchman and two other state prisons unconstitutional. Amit Dominic of Texas Prison Community Advocates warns that climate change is causing longer, hotter summers, escalating risks in prisons. She urges leaders to act quickly to protect human rights.
We do consider it to be cruel and unusual punishment and a violation of an individual's Eighth Amendment rights. Essentially, what we're asking for is that temperatures are maintained between 65 and 85 degrees heat index within all of our Texas prisons and within all of our prisons across the nation.
Advocates also emphasize the toll on prison staff who endure the same sweltering conditions. As Mississippi and other southern states face growing pressure to address prison conditions, advocates are urging policymakers to invest in air conditioning and other cooling measures, arguing that current practices are inhumane. This is Tramel Gomes for Mississippi News Connection.
Aluminum is essential to many everyday products, but at what environmental cost? Demand for many of those products is growing rapidly. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Aluminum is not just found in soda and beer cans. The material is used in all sorts of things, from cell phones and solar panels to electric vehicles and airplanes. And demand for many of these products is growing rapidly.
So not only is demand increasing here in the United States, but it's increasing around the world, which adds up to a whole lot more aluminum.
Annie Sartor is with Industrious Labs, an organization focused on reducing the climate impact of aluminum and other industrial materials. She says aluminum production requires a lot of electricity, and in places like China, where more than half of the world's aluminum is produced, much of that electricity comes from burning coal. So it creates a lot of global warming carbon pollution. But in places where more electricity comes from renewables, for example Canada, which uses a lot of hydropower, the climate impact is far less. Sartor says in many areas, renewable energy is becoming cost competitive.
Coal is not as cheap as it was comparatively around the world anymore.
So she says there's an opportunity for the industry to switch to using more clean energy and limit the harm aluminum production has on the climate. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Processed meat and red food dye are considered to be carcinogens, but only one of them has been banned. But why are there different efforts to push out red food dyes and not processed or red meat? Simone Perez has the story.
Red food dye and processed meats have similar cancer risks to people across the country, but the Food and Drug Administration last month only banned one. While conversations surround carcinogens like ultra-processed foods and food dye, similarly carcinogenic items have not received nearly as much attention. Processed meats like salami, pepperoni, and sausage haven't been in the same spotlight as red food dye, which health advocates petitioned to have removed from foods by the FDA late last year. George Washington University professor Doug Evans says something so artificial like food dye is more easily connected to potential health risks by the general public.
Avoiding foods that have a lot of processed ingredients in them, trans fats, processed sugar, that has been framed, right, in the public mind. And so when a new restriction on something that fits in that category comes along, people are going to be more receptive to it.
The World Health Organization labels processed meats as carcinogenic, but they don't come with any warning labels. Despite health concerns, there are no major campaigns or rallies to stop people from eating processed meat, and public health messaging remains limited too. One expert says that's the result of the complex nature of health, nutrition, and what people think is good for them. Harvard University professor Timothy Rebick, who teaches about cancer prevention, says public health messages should focus on what people should eat, rather than issuing dozens of rules on what they should limit or avoid altogether.
We're talking about some fairly complex, sophisticated science that has a lot of caveats. It's a very complex message if you wanted to really capture the science adequately. And so the simple message people in government agencies started making are very much around to keep it simple, but really capture the essence of the science.
Some of this message might be working. Meat consumption is at an all-time high in the U.S., but beef consumption has been on the decline in recent years. One study finds people have stopped eating processed meats due to their links to cancer, heart disease, and diabetes. This story was produced with original reporting from Jessica Scott Reed for Sentient. I'm Simone Perez, Maryland News Connection.
A new play about neurodiversity premiered at Portland's oldest professional theater company on Sunday, February 23rd. KBOO's Carrie Stewart-Lengle dropped by during technical rehearsals last week to bring us this backstage report.
Well, it's going to be a little funky because this is the one where we're facing that way, yeah?
Yeah.
Bad apple, bad man.
Man. Sam.
El conquistador.
Neurodivergent characters are becoming more visible in pop culture. Whether they are officially on the spectrum or just coded that way, like Young Sheldon or Geek Girl.
She just said apple.
Maybe.
To name or not to name, that is the question.
I think she did.
Or at least it's one of the questions raised in a smart new play premiering at Artists Repertory Theater in Portland.
Sapience is a brand new play by Diana Bourbono, and it features a primatologist who is trying to teach a young orangutan named Wookie how to speak English.
Director Mallory Mira-Shrafi.
Things get a little complicated in the lab. Her boss is her ex, and her cousin, who also works in the lab, brings her young son to work, and he develops a surprising friendship with Wookie.
I know. You hairlesses are so easy to read.
One of the aspects of the show definitely does have to do with neurodiversity and sort of disability in all of its shades, visible and invisible. We wanted to make sure that we cast that role authentically, and so we've been working with an organization called FAME to both cast that role, but also to make sure that this play is rooted in the community that it's talking about.
The FAME Academy in Portland, that's PHAME, is a nonprofit organization that offers fine and performing arts education to adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities.
I wanted characters who actors on the autism spectrum could play.
Playwright Diana Bourbono.
There are characters in there that are specifically on the autism spectrum, and that's who they are. And if the actors have that, they can bring that to the actual character.
You know what? I actually think it justifies the line a little bit, too.
Yeah,
like, this is ridiculous.
People who are neurodiverse communicate in a different way. You have to listen in a different way to understand what's being said.
Clearly, neurodiverse voices have been well represented throughout the development process.
Something we've seen a lot at productions recently is doing a sensory-friendly production. I had questions about that. How do you decide what is friendly? And so I was looking at other options and came across this organization called Culture City. They're wonderful. They work with a lot of orgs across the country, performing arts organizations and otherwise. They famously did the Coldplay tour.
Culture City is a nonprofit based in Alabama.
It's called a sensory bag. It includes things like noise-canceling headphones, weighted blankets for your lap, fidget toys, strobe reduction sunglasses, all the good stuff. And so those can be checked out for free by anyone who needs them at concessions.
It's okay to pick fruit for fun?
That was the idea.
Diana Bourbono started out as an actor and used to joke that she'd done all the Latina roles musical theater had to offer, or rather, both of them.
El Conquistador.
That was before Lin-Manuel Miranda in The Heights and Hamilton, of course.
Representation, it sounds like such a highfalutin thing, but it's literally like there's just not enough roles. I think people just want to see their stories on stage. They want to see themselves on stage.
Like, I think it's a good conversation to be having, especially right now, as like there's a lot of fear around identifying certain ways,
mm-hmm.
and how one might be persecuted for identifying a certain way. And that moment is intersecting with this moment that so many people feel empowered and free to claim their identity and stand in it powerfully. And I feel that political moment in this play so clearly.
It does feel more dangerous now. It feels more exposed. It just the fact that both race and gender have been called out as you know, topics that, for example, the NEA cannot fund. That's new. It's blatant. It's out there. And it feels dangerous. It feels dangerous to be an immigrant. I keep wondering whether my citizenship papers are going to get revoked, you know? But on the other hand, I'm angry and all I have is my pen, and that's what I'm going to use. I mean, if a little play about a sparkly shark can freak them out so much that they get rid of the entire, you know, board of directors at the Kennedy Center, well, what? Hell, why not?
Performances of Sapience continue through March 23rd at Artists Repertory Theater in downtown Portland. Reporting for KABU Community Radio, I'm Carrie Stewart Lengel.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News for Friday, February 28th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Dave Johnson, Elam Case, and Carrie Stewart Lengel. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is the delightful Jasmine Moss. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Nadia Ramlagan, Simone Perez, Tramel Gomes, Alex Gonzalez, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News